Thanks, everyone. We'll still honor this session in terms of this time gap, and we'll just move lunch a bit. I think this is one of the more interesting or most interesting sessions of the day. So we'll honor the session. We'll move out lunch a bit. We've got a bit of time in the afternoon. So my job is just to settle you down and really hand over to Clayton. Obviously, healthcare actuary, but he's also the chair of our COVID-19 task team. He'll be chairing and managing the panel and introducing all of them. I think he's just being set up at the moment. So we'll hand over to Clayton.
Thanks, Alex, for the introduction. And thanks for giving me this hot potato to chair this NHI session. The idea is that we want this to be quite interactive. So it's not a presentation by the healthcare committee. It's an interactive session. So we want to get as much as possible from you guys today, and of course from my panelists here. The other thing I was thinking before, what I wanted to be the takeout from today is the Actuarial Society, and I was thinking the theme for today is how can we help. So us as the Actuarial Society, how can we help anything to do with NHI? I know that there's a lot that is unknown and uncertain, but believe me, we actually know much more than the general population. So is it to do with funding, what's going to happen, the timing? So look from it as with the theme, how can we help? Right, so quickly I will introduce my panel. There's one missing. Hopefully he'll come through, but I'll introduce my panel and then they will say a few things from, you know, say who their constituency is from, and the few key things on NHI, and then a few things on what they want to say to us as the Actuarial Society. And then when we are done, then we will ask questions from the audience. There is a paper obviously in front of you, so today I want questions from each and every one of you. Not necessarily questions only, but also suggestions. So at the end, I'm going to collect all the suggestions from all of you, and then we will feed that into the NHI subcommittee that Alex referred to earlier. So there is no small or suggestion or question. All questions and suggestions are welcome. I was saying in particular to our young actuaries, what I tend to find is that the best ideas come from the young ones, and also those that normally don't speak. Today I don't want to hear much from the ASA Healthcare Committee. I want to hear from the rest of you guys, please. So I need an idea from each and every one of you, and I'm going to collect that. Okay. So in terms of my panel, I'm going to start with Dr. Dumani Pomela. He's the one next to me. He is the CEO of the Private Hospital Association, ASA. When I was Googling yesterday, I found interesting things about ASA. They don't just save our lives, they employ about 250,000 people. And what was impressive was that more than 82% are female. So that is very impressive and empowering. So well done, Doc. The doctor has a master's in public health, and he wants to emphasize that he is not aligned to any particular hospital group. So, Doc, if you can start, please tell us when the Minister of Health was signing the Act. One of the things that he said, obviously, was that the NHI will set the prices for the hospitals. He mentioned, for example, that we will say to your hospital across the road, we'll give you 1,000 patients. He gave an example of maternity, and he said that, for example, we'll give you 1,000 patients, but we will work with an assumption that 25% are cesarean, the other 75% normal deliveries. So he says if, for example, a normal delivery is $100 and the cesarean is $150, then you have to work with that 25% cesarean, not the what he called 90% cesarean rate in the private sector, which he said is too high. So maybe you can start with that and then share what you wanted to share with the actuarial society.
Sure. Is am I on now? I don't hear my. Oh, there we go. Thank you so much, Clayton. And I suppose we are having a much bigger discussion today than some of the examples you've mentioned, which have been published mostly out of context, and we wouldn't really be sitting here to defend anything. We've got something more important to talk about today regarding the National Health Insurance. And I think the objectives of the NHI, really, we can see the public health imperative, universal health care and access. And we have also been clearly cited to the political imperative. We are South Africans, we know the history of South Africa, and we know the historical promise to liberate people from the ills of the past, and we are on board with that. All of us are sensitive to the plight of the vulnerable majority. We are okay with that, and we are on board with that. And being fully sensitized to that, we are now sitting with an act whose provisions are now cast in stone. I think that's important. They are cast in stone. Because it's important now, how do you move forward from there? It's very different to what it was in previous processes where it was still a bill. It's now an act. And I think it's important to make you as the audience aware of the bills, of the acts, the new acts' impact on health outcomes. And I want to pick up just on two aspects of the new act. The first one is Section 11. In Section 11 of the bill, where it lists a number of things that the fund is going to do to try and be a good fund, so to speak, do the right things, do its job. And amongst them is to negotiate the lowest possible price. That's a red flag. And I'll come to it just now. And the second one is a drum that's well beaten now, and everyone is well aware of Section 33. And which speaks about the role of medical aids. I think there's more qualified people on this stage to speak about medical schemes and their role. That's not the aspect of Section 33 I would like to focus on. I would like to focus on the single purchaser aspect of it. So in what it says, Section 33, there is the explicit part, which is the role of medical schemes, and there's the implicit part, which is really the drive to a single purchaser, which is elaborated on elsewhere in the bill. These two provisions are problematic. The one about the lowest possible price, what we would have liked to see if you had to put something in an act like this, we would have liked to see the drive towards a scientific determination of price and the importance of sustainability. Because the strength of the health system is based on, and it is founded on, the strength of both the public and private health system. The aim should be to strengthen each of those to play its role for the benefit of the public and to provide the services in an integrated fashion without discriminating between the users. We are on board with all of that. However, our experience about a drive to the lowest possible price, we have seen elsewhere in the world. I want to make a very small example where we had a CEO of Brazil's biggest hospital group, and just to illustrate what it could mean to a bureaucrat when and it's put like that in an act. And she was telling us that in Brazil at that point, there hadn't been a price increase, a tariff increase, for 17 years. And the way they were surviving was to actually increase the tariffs, because the private funders are allowed there to operate, was to increase the tariffs to in the private sector to offset that. Now, this is what it could mean to a bureaucrat when you leave it like that. That's problematic. It needs to be removed. It needs to be reframed, because it's going to cause us problems down the line. And very quickly, because my time is up, the single purchaser is a huge operational risk. With state entities do not have fail-safe guardrails that are built into their operations. We don't think this is going to be any different. And to have one huge monopsony buyer that has got without anything for South Africa to fall back on, or even to collaborate and strengthen the performance of that monopsony buyer. You know, I'm amongst actuaries here, I mustn't embarrass myself. Yeah. So I just wanted to point out those two. There's a lot of things in the bill that don't sit well, but for us, those two are really problematic, and maybe we can unpack the implications of that in the question time.
Thank you, Doc. From one talk to the other, Dr. Katleho Motidi is well known to most of us. He is the managing director at BHF. Under his reign, the BHF grown to 8 countries in Southern Africa. He was obviously previously executive at Metropolitan, at my current company Afrocentric, and at Sizwe. I was saying to him that when I Googled, I was looking for, one of the things that I noticed was that he has previously worked a lot of time in the public health sector and at a district hospital. So he has been across across the entire value chain. Dr. Motidi, if you can just give us your opening remarks.
Thank you very much, Clay. Is it audible? Thank you. The National Health Insurance, now an act, is quite topical, and I imagine that those of you who also relax on Friday and Saturday evenings with the amber-colored liquids also engage in these discussions because they are more interested then. And I imagine that those of you who are in the healthcare space would often be asked, what is this thing all about? And I think it's important that we never forget the basics. And I thought I should just split the opening discussion into two areas. My answer firstly would be, it's about the law. Fortunately or unfortunately, whenever policy is actualized, it's done this legislatively and then followed by regulations. And I don't think there are any lawyers here today, but we all have to work with what we are given from the legal practitioners. So it is about the law, and what the lawyers tell us is that the Constitution demands that any law has to be clear, it has to be unambiguous. And from the many discussions that we've had around the NHI Act, that seems to be not the case, because there are many arguments about how we interpret certain sections. So from a technical point of view, we speak to the lawyers. There are many areas where the Act falls short from technically legal compliance to the Constitution. There are areas where it contradicts itself, even how it defines certain things, or it contradicts other laws. For example, its predecessors, the National Health Act example, how it defines essential healthcare services would be different from one to another. There needs to be consistency. And I'm just pointing this without going into too much detail to say that from a legal technical perspective, there are many things that were found wanting when the bill, now an act, was analyzed. And that is a constitutional issue. There are other constitutional issues that have been mentioned. And I'll pick on what Dr. Pomela alluded to earlier. The much talked about Section 33, which relegates medical aid schemes to what is called complementary service provision, to what the fund would not be providing. If you ask anybody, what does it mean? There's no clear answer, because we do not know what the comprehensive package that they say the fund will provide actually means. It's further complicated by the fact that on a yearly basis, the Benefits Committee is going to sit down and decide what the country can afford, because Section 27 of the Constitution talks about provision of essential healthcare services to the extent to which the country can afford. So you'll have to look at a budget and say, we cannot include this year, and the other. So what happens to the other complementary services? And it does bring a lot of confusion and issues. It's about the law, and it's very important to look at NHI Act, because it has now become the third most powerful law in the land. If you go to Section 3 of the Act, it says that if there's any confusion that arises from interpretation of this Act, meaning the NHI Act, and any other law, it is only subservient to two other laws, the Constitution and the Public Finance Management Act. So it's important to see what it says, because from a labor relations perspective, or even the national health perspective, whatever is said in the National Health Insurance Act may actually impact if there's that confusion. From our side as healthcare funders, there are certain things that concern us, and I'll just rattle them without going into too much detail. If there's a need to discuss them, we can do that. If you look at Section 6, I think it's O, sorry, N, it talks about, it refers to the complementary nature of the services that the Medical Schemes Act will provide. Section 55 talks about the minister having the powers to introduce any regulations that will determine the relationship between the schemes and the fund at any time. Section 57 and 58 talks about the schedule. In fact, it's more like the project plan. But what concerns us greatly are two areas. In Section 58, there is reference to amendment to the Medical Schemes Act. The Act does recommend redefining the business of a medical scheme. And then it goes further to say that to redefine what essential health services are. And in that area, it then excludes maternity services. Now, that is far-reaching, and if you go back to my comment around the constitutionality, what it means if pregnancy and maternal services for people on medical aids are excluded, it means that a pregnant person on medical aid scheme cannot get free services either under the medical aid, because it would not be allowed to pay for services that are also available under the fund. Secondly, if you are a card carrying member, I sound like a soccer player now, of a medical scheme, Section 4 of the National Health Act does not allow you to get free services from even the public sector. And this is also echoed by Section 29 of the Medical Schemes Act. So it means there's prejudice. And if you want to talk about infringement of rights or constitutionality, I think those are things that you need to look at. The second answer I would say to my Amber liquid drinking fellow would be, it's not about the law. It's about healthcare. It's about healthcare services. It's about increasing access to these essential services. It's about making sure that whether you are in Sandton or in Porth Adder, the services, healthcare services that you need are actually within reach. And I think that is sometimes lost in the discussion about the law. The intention is to make sure that there's access to healthcare services. So in terms of determining what people actually need, we have to look beyond the Act, because it does not say everything that needs to be done to improve healthcare services. For us in the private sector, it means that we need to look at areas for improvement in the medical scheme environment, or in the employer healthcare services environment. We've been directed by the Health Market Inquiry, for example, that has asked us to look at issues of pricing, for example, issues of governance, etc., to make sure that our healthcare system is actually working well. We also talk about the social determinants of healthcare. I come from Hammarskraal, and I'm told that this is a point where you must say, no, because people of Hammarskraal, I think the place has been quite topical, because we were the epicenter of cholera. And you would say in 2023, why should we be talking about diseases that we should have phased off a long time ago? But it came as a result of lack of sanitation or good sanitary services. Now, if you talk to a relative of mine from Hammarskraal and you try and solve their problem, they say, no, there's cholera. And then you'll tell them, no, why don't you boil your water? And they'll tell you, well, there hasn't been electricity for a while. What are we going to do? You ask them, why don't you buy bottled water? They'll tell you, I'm unemployed for the last few years. And I'm mentioning this because we often lose the discussion, because the Sustainable Development Goals were so designed, they're very comprehensive, and they solve, or they're destined to solve, the challenges that we have, whether we're talking about healthcare, joblessness, etc. But they show the interconnectedness of our universe. You can't talk about healthcare and not talk about women empowerment, and not talk about employment, sanitation, etc. So when we discuss these issues, we need to make sure that we include everything else. And if I come back to healthcare, the WHO advises us to look at five other pillars over and above the issue of financing, which is what NHI talks about. We need to talk about leadership and governance. We need to talk about medicines and vaccines. We need to talk about infrastructure and. If we do all that, then we move closer to actually achieving what the people in both other actually need, healthcare services. Let me stop there. Please.
Thank you, my brother Katleko, for such a comprehensive opening statement. Just a reminder that I will be collecting your questions and comments, so please make sure there's something written in front of you. So, also, I don't know how many of us listened to the president's speech when the bill was being signed. Yeah, I would encourage you, there's a two-hour video on YouTube when the president was signing. So it answers a lot of questions. First it was the Minister of Health, and then the president came and said stuff, and then he signed, and then there was questions and answers after. So all your controversial questions about the timing, what happens now, the role of the private sector, stuff about the role of medical schemes, it's all there, was part of the answers there. I would encourage you to listen in to that. Lusani, so I think I don't need to introduce Lusani. He is our former president. I always joke with him that from where I come from, if once a president, always a president. A president for life. Lusani, one of the things that the president said was that we know that the bill is not complete. It's not a finished product. It's got some gaps, but we had to do it now. And he spoke about that the NHS, for example, in the UK, when it was started, no one thought that it could actually survive, and that it has. And that over time, the idea is that we work on the act or the bill as it is, and make it better progressively over time. You wanted to have a chat on the fact that you sort of like the way that the phasing in of the NHI is going to happen. Your initial opening statements, please.
Thank you very much. Am I loud enough? A gentleman told me that I've got a voice for radio. I say I don't want to put Sbu out of his job, so I'll stick to what I'm here to do. Let's start with universal health coverage, and I just want to read a definition here. It's more from the World Health Organization. It says universal health coverage means that all people have access to the full range of quality health services they need, when and where they need them, without financial hardship. It covers the full continuum of essential health services, from health promotion to prevention, treatment, rehabilitation, and palliative care across the life course, they say. So that's quite ambitious, I would say. But we must understand when we talk about universal health coverage that that's very ambitious. And clearly, it would be very difficult, or it would not be affordable, I think, to provide all of that to every single citizen in South Africa. I think that would be very unaffordable given the state of our economy and all of that. So given that, how best then do you treat this? You've got a government that came in 1994. Carrying the ambitions of many people that have been left out for many years. They had a 1994 plan to say this is what we're going to do. NHI has been on the cards. I think they were advised that this would not be the best way to go about it. We have the system that we have now, the public system, and there have been some reforms in the medical scheme space, putting in some elements of solidarity in there, but not going the full length. And that causes problems. And those are the aspects that we as actuaries have commented mostly on, the gaps or the failures within the medical schemes space or medical governed by the Medical Schemes Act. You now have this bill, no, not the bill, the act. It's now an act, it's a law. It's not, how can I put it? It's not strange to have an act and then give meaning to some of those provisions via regulations. It's not strange. I've worked on the Road Accident Fund bill. I've worked on a similar one for Namibia. And when I was working with a partner of mine on that, we were very specific about this will come in the act, but this will need to be defined in the regulations. So I don't think when any speaker or anybody says, well, this has not been defined and therefore this act is incomplete, that is not necessarily correct. It is normal to define certain things in sort of broad principles to say this would need to be given more specific meaning in regulations, especially in situations where you're talking about prices, because it's a mistake sometimes, or it is a mistake, to define prices and put them in an act and not say that they should be subject to some other kind of review. So those type of definitions are quite important. So when I look at this act, I think there have been aspects where they've been very careful to define things in a way that would allow that kind of intervention through regulations and through the benefits committee, for instance. So when I look at the bill, there are two things that I think, there are many things, but one is around the definition of what would be included, what will not be included. And that is what is of most interest for us as actuaries. But that has not been defined. What has been defined is a mechanism in which that will be defined. And yes, there are many of us that would find that to be, how can I put it, incomplete at this stage. But when you look at what the focus has been, is to say this is what needs to be established. The institutions has to be established in terms of the first phase. And there are quite a number of aspects around that. And I think in terms of the approach here of saying there's an sort of incrementally there will be benefits or services that will be offered to everyone. Because again, if you go to the universal health coverage and ask, can we afford to give everyone everything? The answer is no. So therefore, where do we start? and how do we define that? And that is the intention, to say this is what is going to be offered and so on. I look at that as an opportunity, if I look at us as a profession, to actually assist in defining that. And hence the research topics that have been proposed is focused on dealing with that question of what needs to be included, what is affordable, and in a way that would satisfy those other stakeholders that are looking for change in the current system, especially in the public health system. I think that's very key. And then there's an aspect that we commented on in the process of the bill going through Parliament, and is the issue of the supply side regulator, or some of the aspects or recommendations from the HMI, the Health Market Inquiry. We think those things are very important, because what is happening here is that you've got a single purchaser, that word that my colleague here was struggling with, I also struggled with, monopsony, I think, meaning that you've got one buyer. So at the moment, you've got several buyers. You've got provincial departments, you've got medical schemes, they're all buying in the market. So providers can deal with the provincial authorities, but hardly ever, but they can, technically. And then they deal with various medical schemes, etc. So that is the current system where. In the new system, you'd have one buyer. It's got benefits to it in the sense that it can allow for more strategic purchasing. But as my colleague highlighted, there are huge operational risks there. There are advantages and disadvantages there. If you get it right, you can buy these services at a rate that is affordable, and then you can give access to more people. But if you don't get it right, then more people are going to be without even essential services. It may be even worse than the current system that we have. So there has to be focus on ensuring that works, because that is now an act. That is how it's going to be going forward. But the issue is that then they're going to be tapping into the supply side of the providers. If that remains unregulated, it's going to be a problem. So if the intention is to enter an efficient market, or to create an efficient market on that side of it, I think it would be important to look at that aspect. So that is something that we spoke about. I think those are some of the key issues that we need to look at. I mean, the issue of centralization versus decentralization, it's also a constitutional matter, I think, in terms of taking powers away from provinces and so on. I think that those type of issues will be ventilated in the right setup. But essentially, there are some benefits, as I'm saying, to centralization, but there are also a lot of risks attached to that, given that you now have this very large organization. And there hasn't been, and to be honest, I mean, we don't have good examples in this country of being successful at executing something of that nature. And I think the truth has to be told. So the question is, what is our role in that, given that that is the act we now have? There is going to be this very big purchaser that has now been created. It's a law. And if it succeeds all the constitutional challenges, all the legal challenges, it's going to be what we have to deal with. What I do look at are the opportunities that are still there to shape it, whether it's participation at the board level there, whether it is participation in the benefits committee, the pricing committee. And this enterprise risk approach that Alex spoke about is an attempt to say, let's understand where some of these points or these failure points may come from, and see how they can be influenced. Because what you don't want is for this thing to fail, in a sense that if it is implemented, you would want it to be successful. So in that sense, the phased approach is a bit of a mitigation, in a sense that, and what one would say is that before you move on to the next stage, make sure you bed down the stage you're working on, make sure the systems are in place before you move on to the next stage. So in that sense, we think from an enterprise risk management perspective, this current approach is a reasonable one, but it doesn't mean that all the risks have been mitigated. So this is how we engage in this topic. We think there's some opportunities here, but we think that there are a lot of risks as well. And one is keen to hear from the rest of you what you think and how you view this, and what we could do to assist in the process. Thank you.
Thank you, Losani. Thanks for my panel for the initial remarks. And I think there are a lot of questions for you from the society. Yeah. Gail, is she there? Who is? First question. I'm expecting lots and lots of questions. I'm expecting, like, I can't choose between... Oh, are you still writing your comments and ideas? Okay, Alex. Can we have a mic, please?
I ask to the panel, whoever would like to answer, assuming there's no legal challenges, and that's a big assumption, but let's assume, does anyone have a sense what the Department of Health is working on first in terms of delivering first? Are they still just setting up structures? Do they have any kind of sense of what's the first, I don't want to call it a package, but you know, the benefits or services. Does anyone from the panel have any sense what they're doing daily in the Department of Health NHI team at the moment?
Alex, before I hand over to my panelists, you know, we had Moremi, who was supposed to be here from the National Department of Health, and specifically working on NHI, he was going to unpack those. But when the minister and the president were asked, they said that the next 6 months to 12 months is just to make sure that the establishment of the NHI structures are going to happen. The governance structure, he said phase one, which is now from 2023 to 2026. The two phases actually, yeah, 2023 to 2026, and then phase two, 2026 to 2028. So they said the reason they did that was because of the 2 years that have been stolen by COVID. So they extended. Previously, we were talking about 2026, now it's 2028, just to allow for those COVID years. So they said during the first phase, it's all to do with the establishing of the NHI structure, strengthening of infrastructure, making sure that the public service, the public services are improved at, and that there's also going to be engagement with the Minister of Finance in terms of the funding mechanisms. And they say that they also want to have engagement with the ongoing engagement with the private sector as well, because they are talking about collaboration between the public and the private sector. My panelists, anyone else to add to that?
I could also just to add to what you're saying, and those things were. The things that you've mentioned are things that were actually contained in the bill, that there would need to be amendments to other legislation. That would be the Medical Schemes Act as an example. It would be the one that manages the health aspect, and also in a way in terms of how monies are shared between provinces and things like that. There are many, many other aspects that they have to be dealt with, and it's going to be quite a process to do that. I'm not even sure that the 2 years or 3 years, whatever it is going to be enough to get through all of that. If you think of how long it takes actually to get through a piece of legislation through Parliament, so I still think those things will take quite a bit of time. The setting up of things like the board and the various committees, that doesn't have to take too long, but for those institutions to start working and start making some determinations, I think that might take a bit of time. And to think of about the systems that are required to do strategic purchasing. I mean, what one can see in terms of the NHI website are that they have these directorates now. Muremi was supposed to be here, I think, if I'm not mistaken, he's leading actually the benefits directorate that is supposed to look at that. It would have been very interesting to hear from him what work there has been done, what are the challenges, and what is still to come. I've been in conversations with Dr. Anban Pillay on some of these issues, but there's a discussion that still needs to happen, and hopefully there would be more details shared around what are the challenges and how we could, as actuaries and other fellow professionals, could come to the party to assist in doing that. I do see this as quite a big exercise that will take quite a number of years if we do it meticulously. I think what we had said in the submission is that the milestones moving from the one phase to the other needed to be defined quite, you know, with more details than what was provided, so that we can hold each other accountable. It's like, this has been done, therefore we can move to the next phase. There's a risk of saying, well, we're not figuring this out, so therefore we'll just move to the next one. And I think that would be a recipe for, you know, disaster, and those are the kind of things from a risk management perspective you want to be avoiding such things. So I think that's what I can add to that.
Okay.
Maybe I can just also add maybe one or two lines. I think the department had already started working on a number of these even prior to ascent. But what is also important from a legal process perspective, there needs to be proclamation of certain sections to actually empower the work that is happening. We had expected that at least Section 57 would be proclaimed like at the same time when the prison ascended, but that hasn't been done because it serves as a project plan for actually many of these elements that both of you have alluded to.
Okay.
Yeah, and,
okay,
I'm back on. And I think the one thing that it says in the phases, as you mentioned them, is that in phase two, they will start purchasing. Yeah. The fund will start purchasing from public hospitals. That will be interesting, because for the fund to purchase as envisaged in the Act, certain things need to be in place, certain arrangements. You need to have your purchaser provider split set up. We coming from a dispensation of annual budget allocations, and now for the fund to purchase and to get this show on the road, you need to have that set up. To us, it will really be a very practical piloting exercise to do that. And I'm thinking of all the constraints that are currently in the system that would make it difficult to set up that purchaser provider split. So we'll also be watching what happens there, because the pilots that were previously made, the pilots they had previously, those were not pilots. I'm not sure exactly how one can disc- so it hasn't been piloted in reality.
Okay, next question. Yes.
Sorry, I just wanted to add to what the panelists say. It's Matthew Zalstra from Discovery again, but this time I'm wearing my hat as the co-chair of the Private Health Information Standards Committee, which is an organization, not-profit organization, which deals with developing guidelines for implementation of coding and other standards in the private healthcare industry, but also making them available to the public health. So my involvement has been through technical working groups that have been set up by the National Department of Health to recommend national standards around coding, terminologies, healthcare terminologies. So at the moment, ICD-10 is the only national standard for diagnostic coding, but we've put together a number of recommendations for various other terminologies to be recommended as national standards. So these include movement to ICD-11, ICHI, LOINC, SNOMED, various other terminologies that can be used, WHO's ATC as well for medications, GMDN for surgical devices. So that's on that front, and that will be published pretty soon. We received the draft the other day of the regulations around making those national standards at some point in the future, giving the private and public industry enough time to actually adopt them and develop systems to implement them. And then I also sit on the National Health Information Standards for South Africa. And a lot of work that the NDIH are doing there is around upgrading the public facilities in terms of digitization. So the thinking there is that everything needs to be digital, no paper. Everything has to interact with the HPRS, the Health Patient Record System. All public facilities have to basically interact with that system, as well as private institutions to receive payment from the fund. And a lot of work is around building that digital infrastructure, obviously dependent on CETA to provide all the hardware and connectivity, which is a big problem in a number of these facilities. That is what a big drive under, you know, behind the scenes is happening at the NDOH to make the whole industry ready for implementing some of these reforms.
Awesome. It fits in with our motto as the actuarial profession. Remember, how can we help? Next question.
Thank you. Tatenda from Clinics Health Group. As one of the people who partakes in those castrol-colored liquids on a Friday that Katlego referred to, I think we speak of a couple of things that need to be in place, but I guess the general question is there, given that there are many hurdles and procedures that need to be done or need to be achieved, is there a minimum time frame that we can, and obviously it's an estimate, but how, at a minimum, how many years are we looking at before this can be implemented? Because I think also as actuaries, we look at this as some of us may be at risk of having to jump ship and be agricultural actuaries. So it's just a general question. Thank you.
Are we taking responses now? Let's take a response before we forget the agriculture question. Look, I think they gave time frames there, 2026 and then 2028. The question is whether that's realistic in terms, given what needs to be done. But that is the time frame they've given. That in phase two, which would be, I think, is it after 2026 or is that correct?
Yeah.
That they will start doing that. I think what you are not going to see is a brand new building and then we get ushered into that building. That you're not going to see. Okay, I must think carefully before I say the next thing. I wanted to say that you're going to see a shack that is built, a nice one, and then you've got a two-room, and then a three-room, and so on and so on. There's a bit of that, but maybe not starting with a shack. Just starting with the system that we have now, and incrementally growing that. But I think to manage the risk, you do need to bed down those things as you go. The experience we have now is a negative one. Is with the pilots that really did not seem to have fulfilled their purpose. They just don't seem to have worked. And that should have been the basis on which we're building this. So it's not a good foundation. We're not starting off a good foundation. So hence, where one has to consider, if we are going to have something that will work, that is somewhere close to the ambition, the universal health coverage ambition, there needs to be a whole lot of effort that comes from many of us to assist along for it to work. And one hopes that in that process, then you don't have the private providers, like my Lena colleague here, their businesses just going underwater immediately and things like that. There needs to be some form of sustainability in the system and so on. I mean, those are some of the things that one thinks about. You don't want doctors taking off, the specialists, the very super specialists. There are market principles that need to be considered in some of these things, and you still want those people in the country. Otherwise, some of you would have to fly to go get them somewhere, and that's not the kind of system that you want. So those are the kind of constraints that we're faced with. Whether this 2026, 2028 is realistic, it depends on what gets done between now and then, but there's a lot that needs to be done.
100%, Lusani. So yeah, they said that they had a long discussion about time scales because, you know, given the sheer complexity and volume of the thing that we're looking at, they say that they can't just leave it open and say, you know, we're gonna do it in the next whatever it would look like a pipe dream. So they set targets so that they can try and achieve those. So as we stand now, from my reading and from the question and answer session, it will be start to be implemented in 2028. But they say that because of the phases and the different milestones that are attached to each phase, the president also has good power. If phase one is not done by 2026, the president has got power to change that time scale as well. So, as Lusani said, it will depend on how things pan out.
Yes, I was going. Okay, sure.
Can I? Yeah. I think there's a danger that we're facing that we could wait and not do anything. And I like the theme of the conference, how can we help? I think each one of us, from whether you are in the healthcare space, in mining, or other employers, you have to see to what extent you can augment the process, flawed even as you think it is, and possibly with the delays that are expected. We have to start reconfiguring where we are. And some of this can be gleaned either from the act itself, others just from movement towards universal health coverage. It is true that our healthcare systems are more hospice-centric, more reactive, and there is a need to start looking at the preventative elements of healthcare. So we have to then look at what is it that we can do that does not require law or is not even contained that would actually assist us. We're talking about issues of sustainability. And I'm sure Dr. Bonella would not like me to say this because most of the money that schemes pay goes into hospitals. But it just shows that...
I like that.
It shows we have a sick society. We need to be in a position where we have fewer people coming to hospital because they don't have complications or even more severe illness that they had to take care of. So what are the things that we can do to start improving this thing? So from the medical aid corner, for example, there are quite a number of schemes that started looking at changing the benefits. There's very little room to play with. But I know that they consult their actuaries every year to see how can we expand the preventative benefit package. Because we know 5-10 years down the line, you start seeing some spin-offs in terms of complications and hospitalization rates, etc. We also then have to look at what can we give as an input to the department about those areas that we think may be problematic. In Section 58 of the Act, it talks about if you are in mining or working in the workmen compensation area, this becomes important. There is a change in the ODIMWA Act that's specific for mining, as well as the COEDA, which talks about medical services or consultation for medical services in that area, defaulting now to the fund. Now, if I was working as a OMP, occupational medical practitioner, I would be worried about return to work, because it has been easy for somebody to be injured. Today they are taken to a private practitioner, and then within 2-3 weeks they are back at work. But if you take them through the system, the proposed system, there's a chance that there'll be a waiting period, and it impacts on their return to work. It impacts, it's got other impacts on productivity, etc. So I think let's examine the impact of the Act, and from our corners, start giving input to the employers and whoever else is responsible for decision making to make sure that the entire health system actually works, instead of waiting for the 5 to 10 or 15 years and not changing anything at all during that time.
Christoph has been looking at me and for a while now. Christoph.
Thank you, Clayton. Yeah, everyone is looking at you, Clayton. It's not just me. And I apologize. It might be a bit rude of me to ask a question because I could only join halfway through the discussion and I might have missed a little bit. But I think, NHI has its genesis back in Polokwane in 2007. And certainly in the first decade or decade and a half, there was a lot of talk about, being careful, especially as an actuarial profession, not to assume a hard position, rather provide technical support than, doing something that might seem to be similar to adopting some kind of a position. But the bill has been signed into law, and it is what it is. It's there. We can clearly see it now. I think, on the one hand, one can talk about not being seen to be talking for or against any existing interests, but on the other hand, you could also just go back to first principles and ask, what is right and what is in the country's best interest. So my question really to Lusani is that if I listen to Dr. Katlego Mutudi, I can hear the BHF very clearly articulating a position that it's adopting. I think it's clear, it was also clear at the BHF conference a week or two ago, that the BHF is taking a firm stance, and I think as this policy space develops, it's going to become progressively more difficult to provide any input of any kind without taking a side or stance or without being seen to take a stance. I think at the BHF conference last week or the week before, many lawyers on stage said that the worst possible way to legislate is to leave these wide ambiguous gaps and say that we'll fix it later in regulation. And that in itself can also be a position to be adopted. So I want to apologize to Lusani for putting him on the spot, but he is our public interest actuary, was Lusani and I think said to each other before. We could also refer to him as our public policy actuary. And the question really, Lusani, is, if someone put a gun against your head and give you 30 seconds to succinctly position the actual society's stance at the moment, what would your response be? Or do you think it's too soon to adopt a position? I'm just very curious about how we as a profession are positioning ourselves. Thank you.
I learned from the best, so... Whenever there's a gentleman a while back, whenever he was asked a question with a view to, in a way, sort of, put him on the spot, he will respond with a question. So I will respond with a question. What is your position? Because that is what I'm here to canvass from the membership, to hear what is their position. I've spoken about the way I look at this, the way I engage, which is in line with my role as a public interest, where my role is that of a bridge builder. I'm supposed to build a bridge between the profession and the stakeholders out there. So I do not put anything to detonate and bomb the bridge that I'm building, right? I create that build, and part of that is making sure that there's a very good understanding on both sides, that I have a very good understanding of the membership and what they're saying and what they feel about this, and I have a very good understanding of the policymakers and the public out there. That's my job. So in my analysis of that, given what you've mentioned, public policy, it's about equity and it's about efficiency. So is the current system equitable? Is it efficient? I think there have been pronouncements on that by many stakeholders, even besides the Actuarial Society, about whether it's equitable and whether it's efficient. And how does it actually compare to universal health coverage, which everyone, including yourself, I think, have said that you do agree with the principle of universal health coverage. But what I've heard are different ways in which that can be achieved. I've heard some of our members say that low-cost benefit options will help us to achieve universal health care. Now, if one reads the definition of universal health care, and I just read it before you came in, and I did it deliberately, maybe I need to read it again, but I won't do that. Does it actually do that? Do low-cost benefit options? Does the combination of low-cost benefits options and current medical schemes and the public sector SEs, are they a fair response to universal health coverage given the resources that we have as a country? Maybe the answer is yes, but I don't know. And I'm not able to answer that. I can simply just ask it as a question. So in that sense, if the answer is yes there, it would mean let's retain the status quo. But are you able to stand here today and say, yes, let's retain the status quo? I think if you think that, then you must do that. And I must know that that is the view that members have. The members of the Actuarial Society are of the view that we must retain the status quo at all costs. And then it will be a question of then obviously I will need to reflect on whether that is something that I can represent out there. Or, you know, is it something that represents me in terms of my own values and so on? That will be something that I have to consider. But I've never really heard it openly being said like that. I've heard it being insinuated, but not said specifically that we think that the status quo needs to be retained. So the position, my position, which does not necessarily mean the position of the Actuarial Society, is it my job, basically, my job description, what I was given, is to continue to engage with all stakeholders, understand the pain points, and work to address those. So that is simply what the facilitator said at the beginning of the opening here, is that the question we are asking is that how can we help? And I've also had inputs from other health actuaries who have said the same. I think Roseanne has also said the same. So like, how can we help? There's a lot we can do to help. How can we do that? So that in a way, it may not be the kind of position that one is looking for. Let's take guidance from the membership. If the membership is of the view, especially the membership here, that is more knowledgeable about these matters. I remember the one discussion we had at the Public Interest Governance Committee where after we had written our submission, there's a section that we co-authored with Alex. And there were questions asked, like, when you look at the aspect where we were talking about centralization or the single fund, we looked at the pros and cons. We had about four or five pros, like the benefits of it in terms of efficiency and all of that. And we had about 10 negatives or cons. And there was a question asked, is that a reflection of your views, that there are actually more cons than pros in this approach? And it was not necessarily that we wanted to relay that message, but in terms of the way we wrote our submission, it was looking like that was the view that we had. And we were challenged that what you need to demonstrate, not only to yourselves and the profession, but to the people out there, is that whatever you say it's preceded by a rigorous analysis of the situation. All aspects, not just actuarial aspects, but all aspects related to public policy, public health, and all of that. You need to make sure that your work is preceded by this type of analysis, because these are public discussions, these are public policy issues, and so on. So at times, one is not ready to make big pronouncements because there hasn't been a rigorous analysis that has been done. We had a session here where we looked at the research topics, and I indicated that there's a research topic there that we've been sending out to the membership to help us do research on for the last 3 years, and it hasn't been researched. And I think that if we had done it 3 years ago, would have had more input and maybe could have helped us to arrive at a position. So I think I've answered it in a long-winded way, but there isn't a definite position that I would even suggest that ASA should take at this stage, barring any guidance that we get from the members, a very strong guidance from the members that you need to take this particular position. So I come back to the question that I'm putting to you. What is your position?
Thanks, Lusani and Christoph. I'm just confirming with Alex here. It's 12:45. We're supposed to do lunch. How much time do we have?
So we wrap up.
We can wrap up. Okay. So, you know, as I said at the beginning, please, your ideas, just to go to answering the question that has just been asked now. I still think that our position will be and should be, how can we help? But I want to please collect all your inputs from today. And I'm going to take this opportunity just to give my panelists one minute each just to conclude, please.
I would defer my 1 minute to Christoph. Christoph needs to respond.
Okay, Christoph, you've got 1 minute to respond. The mic is coming to you. My suggestions, please. I can see some not written. I want to see everything written there, please.
Thank you. Thanks, Lusani. You're becoming an excellent politician.
I've always been.
I think if there's, it's useful to ask how we can help. It's useful for the committee, for the health committee, perhaps to assist with formulating. But you know, if I think back to I chaired the board of examiners for the last 10 years, and I mean this in jest, but perhaps what we've just witnessed is a good example of answering the wrong question. If I ask where we stand in terms of NHI, it is not a question, I think, of whether we want LCBOs or whether we want the status quo. I think the question has become very succinct when the bill was signed into law. There's now a very particular mechanism on the table. So the question is not whether we want the status quo. This question is whether we want what is represented in the Act. And in terms of Section 33 is a good example. There are other examples where progressively it will be much harder to talk about it or to have conversations or to ask questions without assuming a position. And if Lusani needs guidance, I think it's useful, Clayton, for the Health Committee or for the members here to formulate positions on those. Alternatively, the position could be that ASA shouldn't take a position and that it's appropriate for Katlego or, you know, the industry to take a position. But I do think we should think a little bit more about that than just raising the questions and having the conversations. The bill has been signed. It's not about the status quo anymore. There's a very clear policy direction that has been painted, and we must now talk about that that policy direction. Thanks.
Thanks. Kero, please, can you arrange to get my my inputs from everyone? Just please collect. And then, yeah, the other two panelists, just a minute to wrap up and your message to the actuarial society.
So, the question has been asked, what happens next? And it's often asked, and I think if anyone answers that correctly and it happens the way they've answered it, I'll send them a postcard. Mm-hmm. The question is, I mean, the reality is that I don't even think that the policy maker is clear on where to start, but there's some moving parts, and we'll follow the movement, and we will react to those moves from the policymaker. But what is clear, what is before us is clear. We have a policy, we have an act. Certain provisions of the act, like I said earlier on, are actually detrimental to health outcomes. So what happens to that? How do we deal with that? It has to go back to Parliament. Somebody has to take it there. I'm not really, as an industry, we're looking at all the movement. We're trying to make sense of all of it. But somebody has to take it back. But there's no other way of fixing it. It's an act now. And we have no choice regarding that.
Thank you, Doc. And on behalf of the Actuarial Society, I would like to say thank you for your contribution today, and good luck to the ASA and your membership. Dr. Mtudi, any concluding remarks from your side?
I think it's important to be factual. There are a lot of pieces of news or misinformation that goes out and causes confusion. So I think it's important that we are vocal, but around the right and the correct things. When there's a need to publish things that are factual, I think you must raise your hands and do that. From an advocacy and lobbying perspective, it's our duties, and we'll do that. We believe that the beneficiary or the health citizen, as we'd like to call them, is the most important consideration in this equation. Whether you are currently enjoying benefits from the private sector or from the public sector. There's a case, and I can't remember the details, but it dealt with a property in the Constitutional Court. But the gist of it was that when you want to apply equity, you don't take away from those who have. You rather uplift those who don't have, because you'd be unconstitutional in your attempts. And I think that's what you want to do. We want to make sure that we improve circumstances for everyone, to make sure that all of us have got similar access to healthcare services. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Mtudi. I will just, Alex, I don't know if you want to say something quickly before I. Okay, I'll just conclude with a statement from the President. He did acknowledge that there are challenges with the Act and the Bill. I think, was quite open to the partnership between the private and public sector. He acknowledges that when you introduce such a big change, there will be opposition and fear. He says that by far the majority of the people in this country support NHI. They he also said that NHI as it stands is not, what was the word? He can say it's not a finished product yet, that we'll work on it. He accepts that constitutionally there will be people challenging the act, but he says that that is obviously their constitutional right to do so. But as a country, we are built on dialogue, working together to overcome our differences in pursuit of a better life for all of its people. And he says that let's work together in the spirit of togetherness, particularly between the private and health and public. To the actuarial society, I again want to emphasize my point earlier. How can we help? We think that we don't know a lot about the Act and NHI, but we have got a lot of expertise in this room, and a lot of data, and a lot of experience. We are much in a better position compared to the ordinary person in the street and in the country, so we can use our expertise, our skills, to assist in the implementation of a successful NHI. I think that's it. Alex, you want to make some announcement on the way forward?
I just want to thank the panelists. If we can give them a hand, and we'll give them a little gift.